You're listening to Law and Justice. It's the 12th of December, and this is our final show before Christmas. I'm joined in studio today by Louise Crowley, who's the Vice Dean of the Law School. And Louise is going to be telling me about the Bystander Project, which is a very exciting initiative. We will also have a piece on adverse childhood experiences with Dr. Sharon Lambert from UCC Psychology. So, Louise, thank you for coming in today. It's wet and windy. What prompted you to design the Bystander Intervention Programme, and what exactly is it?
Thanks, Jane, and thank you for inviting me to talk to your listeners about the Bystander Intervention Programme that we have here at UCC. I suppose, in essence, the Bystander Intervention Initiative was developed to allow us the opportunity to raise this hugely important social issue that is relevant and prevalent not only on our campuses but obviously across society more broadly. And given that we have so many students registered with us in UCC, we feel that they're uniquely positioned to address the issue of sexual assault, sexual harassment, both verbally and physically in terms of its forms of abuse within both the educational and societal context that is UCC.
Okay, yeah, it sounds very timely indeed. And so what does the Bystander Intervention Programme entail?
Well, what we have developed is on the back of incredibly extensive work by my colleague, Professor Rachel Fenton in England, who created a university toolkit funded by the Public Health England. We developed an Irish version of the Bystander Intervention. And in essence, what the Bystander Intervention module seeks to do is, certainly in our case, over a 6-week period, to introduce the students to a number of issues. I suppose fundamentally the concept of being a bystander and being a pro-social bystander, and within that context, recognising their capacity and indeed their role as members of society, both the campus society and society more broadly, and their ability to act pro-socially to support and intervene where necessary to support their colleagues, their classmates, and indeed strangers where appropriate. And once they understand the concept of bystander and the 4 steps involved in being a pro-social bystander, we expose them to the context within which we, in the first instance, want them to exercise those skills, and that is in the context of sexual assault, inappropriate sexual behaviour, both physical and verbal, as I mentioned, and to learn how they can successfully intervene before an event happens, in the course of an event, or indeed after, should someone make a disclosure.
Okay, and so is this programme open to all students in UCC, or is it just for law students?
It's quite unusual in that we introduced it for credit, for academic credit, and also made it compulsory, meaning that progression to year two of whatever your discipline might be would depend upon active attendance at these workshops. And so we, given that that is quite unusual here in UCC to add to the academic credits, we introduced it by way of pilot to better understand its both its impact as regards learning, but also its ability to be incorporated within the existing curriculum and workload of students. And so on that basis, we got permission to introduce it in the first academic year in semester two to just the first year law students. And that entailed 163 law students who attended the 6 workshops. They were required to attend at least 3 of the workshops to pass. But interestingly, our data on completion was that most students attended at least 5 workshops. So as regards what we believe to be the buy-in and enthusiasm on the part of the students, they went above and beyond the academic requirements in terms of attendance and passing the module as regards their attendance levels. So that turned out to be a very successful pilot. We have a lot of data as regards weekly questionnaires from the students' attendance, their learning experience, the impact of the learning, the role of the facilitator, and the data is also gathered from focus groups with both facilitators and the students who engaged with the module was very positive. And so in year two, which is the current academic year, we got permission from academic board to extend it to all 4 colleges in the university. And following some negotiations, we now have it in 3 of the 4 colleges. It'll be delivered to nursing in semester two. It'll be delivered to the students in applied psychology in semester two, and we've just completed the delivery to the law students in semester one.
Okay, very, very interesting. And so in terms of the facilitators, is it cross-disciplinary or are all the lecturers from the School of Law?
So we have 13 facilitators, 3 of whom are academics and the rest are, I suppose, what you would broadly term student services support staff. So from student health and student counselling and other student services. And so it very definitely is not discipline specific as regards facilitation. And what we've witnessed is that people who sign up to it, and they do so on a voluntary basis, very much have a vested interest in the importance of this programme and, I suppose, a realisation of the huge impact, positive impact it can have on all of our students and, you know, by definition then on UCC as a campus and on society more broadly. And so there is huge buy-in from the facilitators, and we have facilitator training and very extensive course documentation to support their delivery.
What will students gain, do you think, from the programme?
I hope an awful lot. What we do know from the data to date is that the students have developed an awareness in the first instance of who they are and their capacity to make a difference in a positive sense. So what we have done is we've, I suppose, opened our eyes to the fact that each one of us is a bystander to events all day long, every day. And that's a very important learning and realisation for our students. They suddenly become aware of their capacity to make a difference for their close friends, but broadly also those around them. They also learn the steps of intervention, so they realise that it's more than just seeing something, it's also about being aware of it, being uncomfortable about a situation, then feeling some responsibility towards taking steps, and then taking those steps and making the intervention in a very safe way. So it's a very educational-based 6 weeks of workshops. And once they understand that capacity to intervene, and when they can intervene, as I said already, we then give them a better understanding of the concepts of sexual assault and rape and the issues of consent, so that they become aware of what actually is not acceptable behaviour. And on a more, I suppose, in terms of more verbal issues as well, it's very important that every student realises that we're not talking about the very severe and very traumatic end of the spectrum solely. And in fact, the majority of inappropriate behaviour that we see and I guess are exposed to would be more harassment or verbal based inappropriate behaviour. And so it's about calling out that unacceptable behaviour. But I think for the students, giving them an awareness of what is in reality a normalisation of an unacceptable behaviour broadly across society. So the fact that someone thinks they can make a comment on someone, what someone is wearing, or make an inappropriate joke, that simply is not acceptable. And so the students learn through questionnaires and social norms questionnaires that in fact, whilst they might be uncomfortable with certain situations and they are surrounded by people who are equally uncomfortable, and what we seek to do is to shatter any false consensus that might exist where you have somebody who is acting inappropriately, that they believe because they're not being called out that is acceptable behaviour. And so that's another key learning for the students, that eureka moment when we return the data to them in workshop four and help them to realise that whilst they might be abhorred by a certain behaviour, actually they're surrounded by people who are also upset by it. And so if they act in a pro-social bystander way and intervene, realistically those around them are very likely to step up and support them. And it tends to assist them in eliminating the inhibition that also often prevents bystanders from stepping up and speaking out. So we do seek to shatter any false consensus that might exist amongst the students as to the acceptability of inappropriate behaviour or language, and thereby creating, I guess, a cohesive group of students who know that they can support each other and be supported if they intervene.
So then I suppose it is about challenging what some people call rape supportive views or that type of
exactly. And I suppose in terms of the students learning, whilst we speak to them about that and they do gain this understanding of how that false consensus can almost give someone permission to escalate their behaviour, we follow 4 weeks of, I suppose, more educational and heavy information dense sessions with two workshops of role plays. And I think it's very important that they have that opportunity to use the learning of the first 4 weeks in a more practical sense in those last two workshops. So how we work it is that in workshop five, the students have scripted scenarios, some of which are based on real life incidents. Others have been crafted by students with the support of Gardaí locally in Cork, and the students role play those. And so because they're scripted, someone acts as the bystander, someone is the perpetrator, someone is the victim, and they verbalise what we would very often have as internal reactions to a situation. But they speak out, they speak to the scripts, and they become more comfortable in a very safe environment of the workshop in understanding how these situations might play out if one was to intervene. And then in the sixth workshop, we have scenarios again, different scenarios, but this time not scripted. And we feel at that stage, and this has been our experience, that the students have gained enough information, enough realization of the significance of their capacity to intervene, to support each other, and also the skills from workshop five, where they have rehearsed these interventions, albeit through scripted role plays, that they do actively engage with workshop six and speak up and really enjoy and feel empowered by the fact that they can verbalize what they might previously have kept to themselves in terms of reaction. Mm. And that in itself is the learning in action of the whole bystander intervention initiative.
And do you think that it's quite normal for people to sometimes want to look away at things that are uncomfortable or, yeah, you know, the will to laugh at something that really isn't all that funny at times?
Yeah, my own sense is that it's less of a will to laugh and more of a, almost, can I call it a survival need to laugh. And that's why we deliver this material to first-year students specifically, although I do believe it's something that not only all of our students, but all of us in society could benefit from. But we really want them to understand that it's, if you feel that you object to certain behaviour or certain comments, that it's okay to speak up, but that, you know, let's be realistic, if you're a first year student, you might be less inclined to do so because you don't know where everybody else stands on an issue. And so in these classes, and they're with their peers, they gain a very, very quickly gain a collective understanding, and they verbalise this as to what's not acceptable. And there is great safety in that because we're giving them the space to express these views. And those social norms questionnaires that we do with them anonymously, but collect the data and deliver back, are phenomenal in terms of in giving the students that bravery, I suppose, for want of a better word, because they do respond hugely positively. So the data shows us that about 95% of male and female students will object or will be not comfortable with certain situations insofar as exactly how we would want them to be. But they generally perceive that only about 60 to 70% of their peers would feel the same way. And so there's a feeling, just as you mentioned, that they believe they might be the only one who might object. And so in that moment in workshop four, as I said, it's like a eureka moment where they look around and they realise, actually, I'm surrounded by people who think the same way. And that does help with removing the inhibition. Of course, there are the other issues that are well documented in the research, particularly psychology research, of which I'm not an expert, but I'm familiar with, you know, and the inhibition, even more publicly, of being the one to step up first. And again, the research will show us that as soon as one person eventually steps up, people will flock in very quickly. But it's that bravery that you need in the first instance. And so even by having this conversation on campus, I like to think that people will be more reassured that this is an issue and that inhibition is a shared problem. And that in stepping up, that people will support each other. That's my hope.
And it makes us all safer if we do step up. And so in the first bystander intervention program that you ran, what kind of feedback did you receive?
The feedback was even more positive than I would have hoped. So this was our 163 first year law students in the academic year 16-17. And all but seven attended the requisite number of workshops, which was wonderful. And I was one of the facilitators, so I can speak to not only the experience of overseeing the delivery, but also being in a classroom every week for 6 weeks with 12 very enthusiastic students. As I said already, the attendance was phenomenal. They're law students. They know the rules. They know that if they only attend three, they'll pass the module, work done. As I said, the majority of students attended five, which to me was a huge endorsement of the value. It's as if they went to the first few and then realised this is worth going to. And in terms of the feedback as regards learning and impact, the focus groups, we asked them, would you have gone if it was voluntary? And they did very honestly admit that they probably wouldn't have, but that they were so grateful that we made it compulsory because it was so valuable in terms of their learning. And every student we spoke to said, please make this more available. Every student needs to learn this. Every student needs to be aware of their capacity to make a difference in a positive sense. Also, we had some disclosures from students, which was difficult, very difficult for them. I have to confess, difficult for me to hear it.
But about things they'd experienced.
That they had experienced, that they had never felt in a position to share. And we received, worked for it very hard with those students. The student counselling services here in UCC are phenomenal. They're very stretched, but they were always there for us. They knew the timing of our deliveries, and so they made the services available to us. And a number of those students were referred and very willingly and happily went for student counselling, some for the first time speaking about it. You know, and one student said to me, I finally know it's not my fault. You know, and that wasn't something that I had anticipated in the first instance in developing it. But having met with those students, that was another learning, but also a hugely valuable, I suppose, contribution that the programme could make to student life here by allowing those students to better understand and to deal with the issues, you know. And I suppose on reflection, I may have been naive to not expect that to happen. And we did do some work in advance, you know, risk management. And I had met with various support groups to get their advice on the delivery, and students who may have been victims or continue to be victims currently who would be sitting in the classrooms. And I had been assured in the strongest possible terms, and I only came to realise this when it happened, that victims of sexual assault and survivors of sexual assault are often the strongest advocates for such programmes, because they really want people to be aware of what can happen and also how support can make such a significant difference. And so students have also said to me that they suddenly are hugely aware when they go out on a Thursday night or a Saturday night of people around them, of circumstances around them, in a way they would never have been.
More tuned in
and more aware of each other and the need and the capacity, I think, to support each other. And I think that word capacity is hugely important, because students now know that they can, and they have some sense of responsibility to each other that grows from this awareness, not only of the people around them, but also of what can go horribly wrong. And I think as well, very importantly, and we learned this from a number of recordings and video clips we share in class, of the different times of an evening, the various stages where an intervention can very successfully and very discreetly happen and make such a difference, not only to that evening, but to somebody's life and their well-being. And so I think that sense of awareness and social responsibility and peer support is phenomenal. And even outside the sexual assault, sexual harassment context, I think that that is a huge learning for all of these students as regards their social responsibilities to each other more broadly. Mm. And the learning in bystander intervention, of course, extends to, you know, antisocial behaviour, to bullying personally online, and that students become aware of their capacity, as I say, to be a pro-social bystander and make that difference.
At its core, is the programme about improving the student experience and making it easier for, especially, say, first-year students to navigate the shift to independent learning and living, do you think? Or has it a bigger goal about kind of making people more civic citizens and more responsible people in terms of their own sexual behaviours and attitudes?
I think it is and can be both. I think in the first instance, we're allowing students and we're exposing them to the space that is their personal development. So they come to us here in UCC, I suppose, in the first instance to gain the academic learning. They pick their discipline. They study with us at undergraduate level and like to attain the best degree that they can. But we must remember that whatever their age, you know, it's a transition, it's a learning. They're exposed to new situations. They meet a whole load of new people. And obviously our biggest cohort of students would be the traditional Leaving Cert students. And so they're at a very interesting, stroke challenging age where they may come across situations they're not aware, haven't been aware of previously, or they're not comfortable with. They're not sure what the social norms are, how they should behave. But what this does is that it allows them to develop their own personal awareness. It certainly educates them around very important issues such as sexual assault, rape, consent, acceptable language, acceptable behaviour to each other. But it does so whilst allowing them to develop and developing these skills, as I said, that are hugely transferable. In my mind, it speaks to a broader capacity for the university to continue to develop all sorts of opportunities for students to I guess, contemporaneously with their academic studies to develop themselves as they need to develop. And so in first year, there may be a particular need as regards safety, well-being, perhaps bystander intervention, but also the social pressures, whether it's alcohol or drug abuse, whether it's personal development, dealing with anxiety and distress in the course of their studies, that all of these skills can be considered and developed whilst in university in a key learning environment, but also a very supportive learning environment. And those skills help our graduates to be better graduates. And they leave university not only, as I say, with the academic learning, but also with non-academic graduate attributes that allow them to contribute to society beyond UCC, but to do so as proud UCC graduates, knowing that they have attended a university where personal holistic development is very important, and the university can and does and may continue to develop to allow that space to grow, to support students to develop in the broadest sense possible.
Okay, thank you very much, Louise Crowley. That was excellent. That's Louise Crowley, Vice Dean of Law in UCC, talking about the bystander intervention. We'll take a song, Alan, and then we'll go to the ACE feature. Thank you.
Come, they told me, our newborn king to see. Our finest gifts we bring to lay before the king. This is to honor him when we come. Baby Jesus, I am a poor boy too. I have no gift to bring that's fit to give a king. But may I play for you on my drum? The mother, Mary, nodded. The ox and lamb kept time. I played my drum for him. I played my best for him. Then he smiled at me. Me and my drum.
You're listening to Law and Justice. I'm Jane Mulcahy, and we're going to have a feature now with Dr. Sharon Lambert from UCC Psychology on adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, which have a series of very detrimental impacts on people, health outcomes, social and behavioural difficulties over the life course. I'm here with Dr. Sharon Lambert from the School of Psychology in UCC. Sharon, can you tell me about your research interests and how long you've been working here at UCC?
I joined the School of Applied Psychology in 2015. My research interests are primarily the relationship between early childhood trauma and how it impacts on your development and issues it might cause in later life, such as addiction, mental health and homelessness. My research interests are primarily driven by my former employment before I came to UCC.
Where did you work before that, or in what type of area, Sharon?
I suppose the three jobs that I've had that have had the biggest impact on my research interests are I worked in Angarda Síochána. I worked as a juvenile justice youth worker, and I was the manager of an addiction service for adolescents. And in the three of those jobs, I was in contact with people who would be described as vulnerable or marginalised. Because of those jobs, I would have started to notice patterns, and it would have led me on to develop these research interests.
Sharon, can you tell me, what are adverse childhood experiences, and why do you think it's important that people like teachers, social workers, healthcare professionals, those working in the criminal justice system, and maybe even judges, learn more about their impact?
I suppose in the last 10 to 15 years, we know more now about how the human brain develops than we ever did. And that's primarily because of advances in MRI scans. So one thing that we know is that the brain isn't fully formed until somewhere between the age of 19 and 23. But when children are very, very small, a lot of brain development is going on, and new networks are forming all the time. And that helps them to understand the world that they live in. So what we know from research and from brain scans is that if children are exposed to a lot of toxic stress or adverse childhood experiences, that actually impacts on the way in which the brain wires. So at a time when a child should be forming new connections, if they're exposed to significant childhood trauma or stress, instead of new connections developing, what actually happens is what we call synaptic pruning. So what that means is that little connections in the brain actually die really at a critical time when they should be building and building and building. So there was a very big study done in the States called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, and it was a measure. So there's 10 items on that scale, and those items refer to traumatic experiences that can happen as a child. So they fall into the categories of abuse, neglect and household dysfunction. So abuse, as you can imagine, are things like physical abuse, emotional abuse and sexual abuse. Neglect then would be, you know, it is what it is. It's, you know, being hungry and not being taken care of properly. And then the household dysfunction relates to other family members living in the house. So living with a parent who has a mental illness, living with a parent who has an addiction issue, having an incarcerated relative, or experiencing a very difficult separation or abandonment from one of your parents. So the ACE study found actually that adverse childhood experiences are quite common and that most people have at least one. But what we know from the Adverse Childhood Experiences study is that once you have 4 out of 10, that is clinically significant. And what I mean by that is if you're scoring more than 4 out of 10 on that scale, that you are at increased risk for later physical and mental health issues, irrespective of any life choices that you make. So because it has such an impact on the way that the brain is developing, it has an impact on the whole body, and that increases your risk for illness and disability and disadvantage.
So it's actually quite costly for the state to have these adverse childhood experiences in the population.
Absolutely, it is. There's both a personal cost and obviously there's a financial cost. So if you have somebody who's scoring 7 or 8 out of 10 as a child, we know that statistically the outcomes for them could be quite poor. So whether that be physical health such as chronic lung disease or heart disease or mental health issues or addiction issues or homelessness or involvement with the justice system, all of those things have a personal cost to the individual and their family. It perpetuates a cycle of trauma, of course, and it also has a financial cost because the systems end up having to pay for the disability and the disadvantage and the difficulties that people face as adults.
And Sharon, when you were working, say, with young people in addiction services, did you see these type of impacts in your daily work? Did you see young people with, obviously they presented with addictions, but were there other things going on? Does the ACE study make sense to you now, having come from practice into academia?
Absolutely. I suppose one of the things I noticed when I was working in an addiction service, very quickly I felt that none of the young people we worked with had an addiction, but actually what they had was a huge need to be able to self-medicate their emotional distress. So if you've experienced a lot of trauma or stress, as I said, it changes the way that the brain wires. And what happens is that the brain ends up in a fight or flight mode all of the time. So children who are experiencing that feel very emotionally charged all of the time. And because the brain has been impacted, they don't have the ability to self-regulate and to regulate their emotions. So one of the things that's really great at regulating your emotions, of course, is using substances. Anybody, you know, who has a stressful job, if they go home in the evening time, they say, you know, I'm going to have a glass of wine. And you'll know that that will help regulate you very quickly.
Calms people down a bit, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. It helps to bring you back down a small bit. So drugs and alcohol are great for doing that. They're great for regulating that emotion. So what you have is a group of young people who've had these experiences. They're really, really struggling to regulate their own emotions. And one of the ways that they do that, because they find it difficult, of course, to access mainstream services because their behaviour can be viewed as challenging.
They're kind of combative.
Yeah, so, and actually what it is it's totally adaptive. So, you know, if you have a child that's very aggressive, they've probably needed to be, and it has probably kept them alive. So that's an adaptive response. But of course, when they present to a service, rather than seeing it as adaptive, we might see it as challenging and difficult. Mm-hmm. And lots of services won't be able to hold the young people in their service because their behaviour doesn't meet with what they expect. Mm-hmm. So children fall out of education and they fall out of all of those other services, and they use drugs and alcohol to medicate themselves, to make themselves feel okay. I collaborated on a PhD from clinical pharmacy in UCC a number of years ago. Dr. Kevin Murphy completed some research in our service on young people's use of benzodiazepines, and one of the things that kept coming up was the theme that you don't feel.
That was the desired effect.
Yeah, so the young people were saying the reason why they were taking benzodiazepines was it just totally numbed them. And it stopped them from feeling. And that allowed them to be able to live with their own heads and to be able to manage their emotions.
Okay. Are things like talk therapy then helpful to people at all if they actually want to suppress?
Talk therapy is difficult for young people because they often are not connected to the emotional part.
Okay.
So the cognition and the emotions are not connected. So they might feel very angry all of the time, but actually what they are is frightened.
Okay.
And because there has been, you know, significant years of damage done, it takes a very long time for young people to be able to establish a trusting relationship where you would be able to work with them to be able to get them to a place where they feel safe enough to be able to talk about those emotions. And if you think about the pressures that are on our services, in most counties there would be a 12 to 18 month waiting list for child and adolescent mental health services. And then when you get an appointment there, they have very limited resources and a very big waiting list. So they often can't invest 6 months in relationship building, which is what would be required before you'd ever start any kind of therapeutic work with a young person. It would actually be unsafe
To open up the can of worms.
To open that up if you don't have all of the other services around you to support you.
So is the CALM system kind of broken then?
Oh, I think it's been well established in the media that the CALM system is not operating like people working there would want it. I mean, nobody wants to see these really long waiting lists. And you know, people would like to engage more with people who are more difficult to reach. They are more likely to not turn up for appointments. And how can a system that's under-resourced work outside of that? So, you know, ideally, if somebody can't attend an appointment because they're so emotionally distressed, it would be nice to be able to send a psychologist out to a house and start slowly building a relationship with that young person. But unfortunately, we don't have the resources.
Simply no resources. No.
You described there earlier a few of the negative impacts that multiple ACEs can have on a person over the life course, including addiction. There are other social impacts that can affect people, like inability to form positive relationships or interaction with the criminal justice system. Is addiction or unmet mental health need, are those contributing factors to those social and behavioural outcomes, do you think?
Absolutely. I think, you know, this for a number of years, it's been a chicken and egg conversation, which comes first, mental health or addiction. You know, so some people might say, oh, that somebody has developed mental health issues as a result of their addiction, or vice versa. And in my research, for people who've experienced a lot of stress and trauma, particularly in their very early years, actually the mental health has been present for a while, and then the addiction follows, and that's as a response to that emotional distress. And when somebody's in addiction, it's very difficult then to meet their mental health needs, because it's very hard to separate out what's going on here. Is this mental health or is it addiction? And most of our services don't work with both, so we don't have
this whole dual diagnosis debate.
We don't have dual. No, it's changing, but a lot of it is to do with resources. So, you know, if you send somebody to a specialised mental health service and they have an addiction, you don't necessarily have addiction workers there, so they'll be referred back to addiction. And if addiction are concerned about unmet mental health needs, they won't want to take away people's substances, because it's the only thing that might be allowing that person to stay, you know,
alive.
Maybe. Sometimes, yeah. So you end up with people who bounce over and back between services, and that's very damaging. So then obviously there's a social cost to that, because people struggle to stay in education, they struggle to gain employment, you're in poverty, you might have drug debt, which might lead you involved with crime. So you end up, you know, with a number of different difficulties, justice difficulties, lack of education and employment, unmet mental health needs, and, you know, kind of quite chaotic situations, and many people may end up experiencing homelessness now. It's very difficult for people who have, you know, stable, steady incomes to secure housing, never mind people who are experiencing a chaotic lifestyle.
Or presenting with challenging behaviours. And Sharon, you recently were involved with a fascinating piece of research with the Cork Simon community, where you conducted the ACE score with all the service users there who had experiences of homelessness. Can you tell us about some of the findings from that study?
Well, it was a really interesting project to be involved with, because all of the staff who work in Cork Simon and the volunteers, you know, are very conscious of the fact that they work with deeply traumatized individuals. That was known to them. However, what we didn't know was the extent and the breadth of it. So we ran this study last year where service users in Cork Simon were surveyed using the ACE scale. And what we found was that 100% of them had at least one ACE. Okay. And almost 80% had four or more. So that's where you're into the clinically significant score. You know, we had 8% of the service users had 10 out of 10 ACEs.
Yeah, I found that shocking. How are they even alive at all?
Yeah, and I would say the reason why they're alive is because they have drugs and alcohol to help them cope.
Right, okay.
But for the fact that they have that, I think that they may not be able to live with their emotional pain. The statistics for outcomes for people who get 10 out of 10 are very, very poor. And of course, what we know in Ireland is that the life expectancy for people who are homeless in Ireland is quite low. It's in the 40s, early 40s.
With someone with 10 ACEs, do you think it's ever possible to deal with the trauma, or are they destined to a life of addiction because it would be unsafe to try and wean them off their substances?
I suppose I'm a psychologist, so I always believe that there's
hope.
There are some people who may never be able to live drug and alcohol free, so they might be on a low dose methadone for the rest of their lives, or they may use cannabis. So I suppose that's why when you hear arguments about harm reduction models, and I know that that's becoming much more acceptable now. There was a time when that was very controversial, but I think that we understand now that there are people who may always need something to be able to help regulate themselves. And we have to look at, well, you know, are they able to stay in their accommodation? Are they able to keep up with their bills? Have they started to develop some kind of learning?
And they have a quality of life.
Absolutely. There. You will meet, you know, the odd individual who has 10 out of 10 who's just doing really, really well. They're just incredibly resilient people. Can we always understand why there are some people who are more resilient than others? It's very difficult to know. But certainly I would be a big believer in that there's hope for everybody. What I would say is if you have somebody who has 10 out of 10 ACEs and you want the best possible outcome for them, you have to have all of the services around them supporting them.
Okay.
Justice, education, social work. Some of the services do not operate in a trauma-informed way. What can happen is with some of the services is they can actually re-traumatise individuals.
Okay.
So, for example, for some reason we're all afraid of snakes and spiders, even though that's not an issue in Ireland, because once upon a time it would have been an issue.
Okay.
So your brain says to you, you need to be frightened of this. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about why. You just need to be frightened and we'll take care of the rest. When you're in danger, we'll operate your flight and fight system. We'll do it unconsciously. You won't have to think about it. So the brain wires all of these things as you're growing. So if you're living in a home and lying in bed at nighttime, you're waiting and you're waiting for something bad to happen. That imprints on your brain, and what happens is your brain connects waiting with danger. So it tells you that every time you ever wait, you're in danger.
Mm-hmm.
So if you present to a mental health appointment, mm-hmm. for example, and it's at 10 a.m., and you present at 10 a.m., and there's 10 other people sitting in the waiting room, and they all have exactly the same appointment with the same person mm-hmm. for 10 a.m., then
you're going to be waiting for an hour and a half or two.
And I think we've all had that experience where we've gone to appointments and we've had to wait. Now, for somebody who's had 10 out of 10 ACEs, what happens is the brain says, after 10 or 15 minutes, the brain says, we're waiting.
Mm. And
the fear starts
to throb or whatever.
It's totally unconscious process. So the brain says, we're waiting, you're in danger, I need to get you out of here. So it triggers the fight or flight system.
It's interesting.
Yes, so you either become extremely aggressive and you start fighting with people, or you flight and you just run from.
Mm.
So what happens is the people who need to attend the services the most are the ones who don't have the capacity to manage the system.
It's fascinating. I was reading a blog, We Need to Talk About Trauma blog, about A&Es and how people can be sort of dismissed as having personality disorder quite frequently. Is the personality disorder diagnosis, I know it's somewhat controversial, but could it perhaps be better understood as people having multiple ACEs if we were to unpack it and ask the questions?
There are certainly a number of people who would argue that we should scrap some of the personality disorders, and that actually it might be more appropriate to have a term called developmental trauma disorder. I know it was argued for in the last round of the DSM, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, so that's the list of all of the different psychiatric disorders. So we're on number 5 at the moment, DSM number 5. There was certainly a push to have developmental trauma disorder in that. It didn't happen. I would hope that as we continue to gather more and more research, that will start to come in. And I suppose, why do I think it's important? I think it's important because, you know, if you diagnose somebody with, for example, borderline personality disorder, and they go home and they Google it, what they will find out very quickly is that there's no treatment.
Right. So again, the hopelessness.
It's the hopelessness. You have this personality disorder, and the only way we can deal with it is management. So we manage that disorder. And of course, it doesn't really provide an understanding as to why you've ended up here. But when you talk to somebody about and say, you know, you have developmental trauma disorder, there's an understanding then, okay, you know, I'm here now as an adult. I've had a difficult journey to get to this point. Lots of people have blamed me for my own behaviour, and I'm certainly blaming myself for my own behaviour. And if you put it in the lens of developmental trauma, people can say, okay, really bad things happened to me. That influenced the way in which I developed. People perceived me as having all of these choices, but actually I didn't have a choice. What I did was I did what I had to do in order to survive. And aren't I great that I have survived? Mm. And now what I'd like to do is spend some time recovering.
Mm.
I think sometimes with the personality disorder diagnosis is people feel that there isn't hope for recovery, whereas there's huge hope for recovery from trauma.
Mm.
And I know even when we did our study with Cork Simon, what was interesting was the feedback from the service users. So they would say things like, wow, that really helps me to understand
Why? That is fascinating.
Yeah, and a couple of people said it's really nice for me to now see that despite the fact that I had all of that as a child, and despite the fact that I'm still in difficulty, obviously, because I'm experiencing homelessness, that I actually have come a long way. Mm. And I think that people can be kinder to themselves.
That self-compassion.
Yeah, so you can be kind because it's not my fault.
Yes.
You know, that I've experienced this
and
trauma as a child.
It takes a bit of shame away, maybe.
Absolutely, it takes shame. And I think as well, for people who have to work with service users who can be perceived as challenging or combative, that, you know, if you say to somebody, well, they've got developmental trauma, I think that there's a compassion that goes with that, mm-hmm. from services and from the person themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's more conducive to recovery, mm-hmm. than a label that perhaps can be seen sometimes as not being able to recover, mm-hmm. from.
I know you're very keen as a psychologist to promote trauma-informed care or practice. What actually is that then? How do services become trauma-informed?
Trauma-informed practice is where a service becomes educated on the impact of trauma on the brain and how it causes certain types of behaviours and how those behaviours are adaptive rather than challenging. So if you have a trauma-informed service, they know the research and they understand that people behave in particular ways because that's what they need to do to survive. So you adapt your policies and your procedures to match that. So, you know, you'll have services who'll say, if you fail to attend 3 appointments, you're out and you're back to the back of the list. But if it's a trauma-informed service, what they say is, I understand that it's very difficult for some people to engage with services. So rather than pushing them out after 3 mm. failed attempts, you sit back and you say, well, why is it so difficult for Johnny to attend this appointment? And you connect with Johnny and you say, what can I do in order to make my service work better for you? Mm. So some services sometimes, and this has been shown a lot in the research, is that they can have a client blameworthy perspective. Okay. So Johnny didn't turn up because he couldn't be bothered and he's not motivated. And of course, one of the things that we know about experiencing trauma is that it affects chemicals mm. in your body. And one of the chemicals that you need to feel motivated mm. is dopamine.
Okay.
And if you look at people who've experienced a lot of trauma, they have very low levels of dopamine. Mm. So you're asking people to do tasks that they're physically and mentally not able to do. Mm. And then when they don't do it, we blame them for not doing it. Mm. When actually we just haven't thought about the research and said, well, how does this apply here? So that's something very simple. If Johnny fails to attend 3 appointments in the row, is it your service's fault, actually? Mm. So the service will reflect on itself and say, what can we do in order to support Johnny to be able to engage with our service? You stop saying things like, he's unwilling to engage, and you say things like, he's unable to engage. They're two totally mm-hmm. different things. And if somebody's unable to engage, what can you do to improve their access to your service? Mm-hmm. Do you need to go out and help them get into a bus? Do you need to change the time of day that you're offering the appointment? Do you need to ring them the day before and the day of? Mm. So it does mean, yes, you have to go an extra mile sometimes, but that's a whole lot better than having a diary full of empty appointments that nobody has turned up for.
Yeah.
And as well as that, what you're saying is the people who need our service the most are the ones who are unable to access it. So it's our responsibility as professionals to understand the difficulties and to adapt our service so that we can meet that. Another impact of trauma-informed services, which is very important as well, is that it recognises the contagion effect of trauma. So what I mean by that is if you work in a service where you're working with service users who are highly traumatised, it can be very high energy, and I know that from experience. And when you're working in a very high energy, high levels of vigilance, mm-hmm. and you're hearing, you know, very traumatic stories all of the time, that has an impact on you as a worker. Mm. So that's why we call it the contagion effect. So if you work in a service with very high levels of trauma, you're at risk for what we call secondary traumatic stress. And if that goes undealt with, you're at risk of burnout. And we do know that there are some professions where there's very high turnover. So, for example, child protection social work has very high levels of turnover. And that's because individuals cannot sustain themselves in systems where they're constantly exposed to witnessing and working with children who are experiencing high levels of trauma. So a trauma-informed service understands the impact on the staff and it puts policies in place to support them.
So kind of staff supervision in a mental health way or talking to psychologists.
Yeah, and, you know, giving people time out, recognising the impact. You know, I think it's interesting because you'll hear people say sometimes, well, that's what you trained to do. You know, but, you know, irrespective of years you spent in college reading theories and all that kind of thing, nothing prepares you for working with a child who's had an absolutely horrific experience. And I think it's very difficult, particularly if you're a professional and you're a parent and you're going home to your own children. You know, it's really difficult work.
Yeah, you become hypervigilant yourself.
Hypervigilant with your own children as well. And it strikes me that, you know, as a psychologist, when I was working in the community, I am obliged, as part of my professional development, I'm obliged to go for supervision, professional supervision, once a month with another psychologist, where I unpack the distress that I feel about, you know, often the huge failures that you have with clients. And what really strikes me is that there are people in frontline services who deal with extreme trauma on a daily basis.
Like prison officers.
Gardaí, social workers, and they don't get access to the kind of supervision that a psychologist get, when actually by the time somebody comes to see a psychologist, that trauma has been impacted by other professionals along the way, because psychologists don't get the 999 call. The psychologists are not in the ambulance, and psychologists are not like child protection social workers where they're going into people's homes. So actually those professionals have dealt with the impact, and it's whoever is the first line of impact absorbs it the most. So actually by the time somebody gets to a psychologist, there are three or four other types of professionals who've impacted that trauma or absorbed that trauma by the time it gets to me, and they're the ones who don't get the type of supervision that psychologists get. And if you continue as a service to operate that way, you have very high levels of turnover, very high levels of sick, and you have very traumatized staff who really struggle to do their work. You will have symptoms, not too unlike post-traumatic stress disorder.
Okay, so it's embodied.
It's embodied. You know, you're not sleeping properly, or you're waking at nighttime thinking about a service user, or you're drinking more than you should be in the afternoon. So, you know, not in the afternoon, I hope, but in the evening time. So that glass of wine that you had with your dinner to help you unwind becomes half a bottle. Or you're struggling to parent your own children because you're so physically and mentally exhausted, or it's impacting on your relationships. What you'll find actually sometimes is people who work in frontline services become slightly socially isolated, and they tend to only socialize with people who also work in frontline services, because
they get it.
And as well as that, they find it very difficult to do the meaningless conversations about holidays and Christmas shopping and that kind of thing, because the world that they work in is so sad and so chaotic and so despairing, that to be able to sit down and have a cup of coffee with somebody where they're talking about Christmas shopping is just such nonsense that it's frustrating. So you'll find that they'll start to disconnect from a social circle because they don't feel that that person is living in the real world. And of course that person is living in the because what we're talking about is a small group of a small group of society that's deeply traumatized, but because you're living in it all day every day, it becomes your reality. And your reality is very different than everybody else's reality.
To wind it up then, Sharon, again, why do we need education about ACEs?
You need education about ACEs starting in preschool, because that's when the behaviours start. So if the earlier that you can intervene with the child, the less damage is going to be done in their development, and the more you can support the family, because children are always better off, where possible, to be supported within their family. Because even when you take children from their families, when they hit their adolescence and they start doing their identity development, which is a normal part of adolescence, it's very difficult for them if they're not in their family of origin. And what you'll find is that many children and adolescents, when they get to an age where they have a small bit more autonomy over themselves, will actually start seeking out their family of origin. And if that family of origin is really, really broken, that's really bad for the adolescent. So if you can support children in the context of their own families as early as possible. So at preschool, when you have a child who has challenging behaviour, a three-year-old or a four-year-old doesn't say, I'm sad, or I'm frustrated, or I'm disappointed, or I'm frightened. Children don't have the capacity to do that. Actually, lots of adults don't. So what you do is you notice the behaviour and you say
that... The lashing out, or the
fearfulness, or the difficulties that the child is having, and you say that child is trying to communicate something. They're saying that I'm not happy, I'm distressed, and I don't have the words to be able to explain that to you. So you intervene as early as possible. And when they go into primary school, if that behaviour is still there, because we have large classroom sizes, teachers don't have the capacity to manage it. So children who are very challenging spend more time out in the hall than they do in the classroom. They become isolated within the school because they're not the same as their friends. They're turning up tired and hungry and frightened. They struggle to form friendships. They struggle to engage with learning. They're not ready to learn when they arrive in at school at 9 o'clock in the morning. So they have a very difficult day. And they get isolated and excluded. And that continues into secondary school. So they end up leaving education. You know, even in the Cork Simon study, the majority of service users that we surveyed had left school by the age of 14 or 15. We had service users who had left school at 10 or 11.
Probably because they've been so labelled and maybe judged by teachers, written off.
Written off, yeah. And it's there's sometimes it feels like children are motivated out of systems. And I don't blame anybody for that. I do think it is a huge resource issue and a training issue. You'll have absolutely fantastic teachers who recognise that this child is really struggling, but they don't have the resources to be able to hold them in the education system, because what that child needs is not to be in a room with 30 other children. They need huge care and compassion and attention, and people who are able to sit with the bad behaviour and not personalise it and not put it back on the child and blame the child for their bad behaviour. So I think we need to start at preschool. Actually, in Wales now, I was talking to somebody last week. We're going to be collaborating on a project, and what they've started doing is they've started doing it at the 6 week checkup. And what they've started to do is they've actually started to give the mom the ACE questionnaire as well and say, right, mom, you know, you have 5 out of 10 of these. You know, I have to tell you that, you know, that puts you at risk for being able to manage your child as they develop, because children are hard work. And if you have reduced capacity, how do you parent? So they start having those conversations about, you know, if you've had a very difficult time as a child, I want you to reflect on how that might be for you as a parent, and that cycle of trauma. Because if you're a mum, for example, who's had 6 or 7 ACEs, we know that you're statistically at risk for mental health issues and for being in a violent relationship. So that child, you know, may possibly already have 2 ACEs, even though they're only 6 weeks old.
So and that intergenerational trauma.
Intergenerational, And, you know, they talk about the intergenerational, the cycle of addiction. I actually don't believe that. I don't believe there's a cycle of addiction. I actually believe there's a cycle of trauma. So you have a cycle of people who are self-medicating, which is a nicer way to look at it. Because, you know, if you have a cycle of addiction, you're writing off a family. A cycle of trauma. What you're saying is, okay, we failed to intervene in the last generation. Let's do it now and ensure that the next couple of generations have
are healthier.
Yeah,
Sharon, thank you so much. Dr. Sharon Lambert from the UCC Psychology Department, thank you.
In my waist, in my butt, I still beg.